All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. And I wanted to talk to you today about some really important stuff here. Today's show, at the end of the show, we're going to be talking about the police murder of 19-year-old Tyler Damon Woods.
He was unarmed when he was shot by the police in Long Beach, California on November 19th, 2013. And we're going to be talking with
Takea Boyd, the mother of her and Tyler's one-year-old child, who's been part of leading a fight to spread the word about this killing and to demand justice for Tyler Damon Woods. And then, though, right now, and this is something I've been really looking forward to doing, all right, I'm really excited about the beginning of the show because we are going to be talking with Elijah Wald, who's the co-writer with Dave Van Ronk of The Mayor of McDougal Street, Van Ronk's memoir. Now, I'm going to get into this a little bit more, but just in a minute or so, but just so you can get a sense of what this is all about. Van Ronk was one of the most influential musicians in the Greenwich Village neighborhood of New York City, that folk scene in the early 1960s, late 50s, mid to late 50s, I guess. And at the time, folk music together with beat poetry, jazz was a stream in an emerging culture of opposition to the suffocating world of 1950s America. And of those times, someone once said that Greenwich Village was where people came to get away from America. Now, over the course of 5 decades, Van Ronk died in 2002. He recorded, not over the course, he didn't, 5 decades did he die, but over the course of 5 decades, and then the point that he did die in 2002, Van Ronk recorded scores of albums that blended blues, jazz, jug band, stomping, and sea shanties, and he became a major influence and mentor to many other musicians, including Bob Dylan, Joni Mitchell, and Joan Baez. And the book that Elijah Wald co-wrote with Dave Van Ronk is The Mayor of McDougal Street, and it's one of the things that inspired the new Coen Brothers film, Inside Llewyn Davis. And I tell you, it's a really interesting point around, a really interesting thing around all this, because if you haven't seen that movie, go see it. I really recommend you go see it. You know, it'll give you a real good sense of sort of what was going on at that time and what people were facing and what they were doing in opposition to all the stuff that was going on in the society, the deadening vibes of the society, the deadening ethos, the dog-eat-dog ethos that was pitting people, you know, pushing people down to the very bottom of you know, where humans should, a place where humans should never be, okay? And I saw the film recently. I was really struck by what was portrayed there. It's a really important and powerful film, as I was saying. And, you know, when you see it, you chew on it for quite a while afterwards. It's like any Coen Brother film. You know, it's not one of those films that actually you walk away and say, oh, that was easy to catch. But I was struck by another thing. The T-Bone Burnett, who was the music producer for this film, described the world it portrays. And I thought this was really apropos to what we're going to be talking with Elijah about today. It was a time when there's a new moment happening. The old has died and the new thing hasn't quite been born. We've been in an interregnum now for the past 10 years, really, where the old has been dying, but it's not dead. And the new is being born, but it's not yet alive. The world has been in this brackish water where it's not one thing or another. The old structure that we lived in for a whole lifetime has been dismantled for the most part, but the new structure hasn't taken. That's from T-Bone Burnett, and I thought it was very, very, just concentrated a lot about the film, about the scene in the village, and about Dave Van Ronk to a certain extent. So I wanted to, you know, really sort of set that off and continuing in the context, contextualizing that. It didn't always look that way, though, for everybody. In fact, it was pretty dark for a lot of people. The U.S. was pillaging the world, massive political repression, social repression inside the U.S., a very flat and suffocating world on one level. But as Burnett pointed out, it was also a world that was pregnant with the possibility of change, the struggle of black people inside the U.S., the national liberation struggles busting out around the world and more. And included in all of this was a churning and searching for meaning and ways to impact the society and the world in the cultural realm. And this found expression in many different ways. And one of the sharpest expressions of this is what was happening in music and art in Greenwich Village. All right. So joining us now to talk about all this is Elijah Wald. And as I said, Elijah is the co-writer with Dave Van Ronk of The Mayor of McDougal Street. And that's Van Ronk's memoir. And Elijah is also, and I love this description of Elijah. He's a musician and a writer who spent much of his teens sleeping on Dave Van Ronk's couch near the corner of 4th Street and 7th Avenue. Elijah, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Sure. All right, man. Well, it's good to hear you. So let's jump into this. I mean, I thought your book was really fascinating. I really got a lot out of it. And, you know.
Well, Dave was a really smart, really funny man. And I tried to get as much of that in there as I could.
How did your participation in writing this book come about?
Oh, Dave asked me to do it with him. I mean, I'm a writer. When I started doing books, he sort of latched onto that fairly early and said, why don't we do a book together about that moment in the village? And we sort of kicked it back and forth and tried to sell it and tried to get enough money that Dave could get off the road for a year and just sit down and work on it. And we got some decent offers, but never that decent. And then he was diagnosed with cancer, and we thought, okay, God damn it, he may only have a few months left, but we'll do the book. And then he started chemo and was dead. And so I was left with a couple of chapters he had written when we were trying to sell the book. And I basically called in every interview I could find that he'd ever done in his life. And like you just said, I had spent so much of my life sleeping on his couch that I really had his voice in my head. So I just finished it as best I could.
Was a lot of that voice, though, Elijah, get the hell up, man. Come on. You got to go home now.
Yeah, really. There actually wasn't a lot of that, because normally by the time I was waking up and getting home, he was thoroughly asleep.
Okay.
I mean, I would tend to wake up, you know, in the 8, 9 o'clock range, and he didn't.
Well, let me actually, Federico, play track 2. I want to give people a sense, for people who are listening who don't have a sense who Dave Van Ronk was and why he and his work was so significant. I just want to give them a sense of a little piece of his work. This is Willie the Weeper. Check this out.
This is a story about Willie the Weeper. Yes, Willie the Weeper was a chimney sweeper. He had the habit, boy, had it bad. Let me tell you about the dream he had. Dee 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 da dee ba dee 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 da 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 dee da da.
All right, that's Willie the Weeper, Dave Van Ronk, and you can find that. It's available broad. Actually, it's available really deep on the internet, but you can also, there's all kinds of sites that have this, and it's Willie the Weeper from Dave Van Ronk. Now, Elijah.
Well, and also there's a brand new 3-CD set from Smithsonian Folkways that has that track.
Right, I was just going to say that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
I got that. In fact, that's what it's, I spent my entire holiday listening to that over and over and over again. So there you go. Let's talk about that, though, because it conjures up something about both about Dave, but it also conjures up something about the scene. And people, I think, don't really have a lot of knowledge about what that scene actually was. What was it all about? What role did Dave play in it?
Well, that's a hard one, because the scene that really the Coen brothers were grabbing in our book, the way that chapter begins, it's the chapter where Dylan shows up. And Dave said that winter of 1960-61, which is where they set the film, was the last time that Greenwich Village felt like a neighborhood. And that's really kind of what we were trying to capture, is that moment before the rents skyrocketed, when it was still, you know, basically a half Italian immigrant, half Bohemian neighborhood. A lot of jazz clubs, few folk clubs had just started. There were probably 5 folk clubs by 60, but a lot of them, they were a weird little mix. I mean, some of them, where Dave held court was a place called The Gaslight, which was still called The Gaslight Poetry Cafe, and had started off with people like Ginsberg and Corso and Diane De Prima. But then there were places like the Café Bizarre and the Café Wah, which basically were tourist traps designed for folks on Grey Line bus tours from Ohio who, you know, would catch a Broadway show and then go down to Greenwich Village to see the freaks. And, I mean, literally, Café Bizarre had a doorman dressed as Frankenstein, and then you'd come in and see the weird beat poets and folk singers.
Well, tell me something. There was, because at the time that that was going on, there were some things where this was really beginning to coalesce as a movement. And I mean, as what the sense I got from the book was actually that he was a major. You know, he wasn't just somebody who was like sort of rolling along with the scene.
No. Dave was the major player on the mm-hmm. scene. Dave was, as they called him, the mayor of McDougal Street. Partly, just he was an awesome physical presence. But also, he was a little bit older. He'd been born in 1936, so he was already 25. My God, compared to an 18-year-old, that's pretty old. And he already had a background in jazz. He knew guitar chords. He had learned some old blues. And he had this kind of amazing voice. I mean, it's a moment he hadn't yet. The track we were just hearing, he always hated that. He thought that period, he always called it Archie Andrews Sings the Blues. He felt he hadn't yet got it. But compared to everyone else on that scene who really did sound like a bunch of white undergraduates, he sounded like the real thing. And he looked like the real thing. He was 6'3" with this beard, and you know, he was immersed in it in a way a lot of people weren't, because he was a working class kid from Queens who really had to do this full time to make a living, while most of the other kids on that scene were still living at home with their folks, and it was kind of fun, but they didn't have to sweat it out in the clubs.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Elijah Wald. Elijah is a musician and writer and co-author with musician Dave Van Ronk of the book The Mayor of McDougal Street, and that's Dave Van Ronk's memoir. Now, Van Ronk was a musician who was right there as the whole culture was changing in this country, and the book has served as the inspiration for the Coen Brothers movie Inside Llewyn Davis. Well, now, there were other things when that scene was beginning to coalesce. There were, you know, you mentioned the gaslight. And then there's two things that stood out to me in the book, too, in terms of, because I was trying to think about, like, how does this movement that on one level is, like, really nebulous in a certain sense, but then, you know, because the stuff that's being put out, there's not, like, people are not, like, organizing themselves necessarily into, well, this is, we are the movement for this or something. But there's actually something coalescing there. And there are things that really played a major role, it seemed like. One was the publication of Caravan. The other was the Folklore Center. Things like what was going on in Washington Square, you know.
Yeah, Washington Square was the center of it all, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Every Sunday afternoon, Washington Square was where everybody who was interested in folk music got together, which to some extent meant a number of warring cliques. I mean, you had the whole, what we could call the communist clique, the kids who'd gone to the summer camps up the Hudson and were singing all the old Pete Seeger and Union songs. Van Ronk always remembered walking past, as he used to say, a covey of them, sitting cross-legged around a banjo player who announced, and now this is a song that the workers sing when they're oppressed, and went into I don't know what song. And then there'd be the kids from Hashemir Hatzair, you know, the Zionist socialists dancing the Hora. And then there was this fellow, Roger Sprung, who was the first guy to bring bluegrass north, and who basically tutored, you know, everyone from the New Lost City Ramblers up through David Grisman in later years. And he would have the bluegrass people. And then there were Van Ronk and the various people like him who were singing blues and ballads. And it was the whole square. I mean, just all these little focal points. And then they'd head off to parties afterwards where they'd keep playing until dawn. And that was basically every weekend. And that was really the center of folk music. It was not a commercial thing. It was just people getting together who loved this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Let me play another track, a piece of another track, because I wanted to talk about the breadth of Van Ronk's musical base. And I wanted to, you know, you were talking about that first song, Willie the Weeper, and his thing about thinking that he didn't sing, he hadn't gotten the blues quite right yet. And then for a lot of people, the whole idea that, you know, of what Dave Van Ronk was about, what he was, what, you know, what his whole persona as a folk singer, you know, was about. And I wanted people to hear The Cruel Ship's Captain. So, Federico, play track 3 for a little bit. I'll let you know when to cut it off. All right.
Boy, to me, was bound apprentice. Because his parents, they were poor. So he took him from St. James's workhouse for to sail on the Greenland shore. One day this poor boy, he did annoy me. Nothing to him did I say, but I rushed him to my frozen yard, and I kept him there till the very next day.
All right, again, you're going to have to look that up and listen to it yourself, because we're really trying to rush through a whole life.
That's from the CD I did to accompany the book. That's from the Mayor of McDougal Street CD.
Right. I was going to say that it was really, that CD, by the way, is really striking. And I thought your comments on the website were very cool, man. Very cool. Let's talk about this thing, because you get a sense of him and his voice and what was concentrated in him. And, you know, and the beauty and the power of his art. And it also led me to think about the thing you had talked about, the warring cliques of folk singers, and the thing of what came up in his life, and how he began in traditional jazz, then he moves into something like this, and then he became part of, I think we called him, what did he call him, the neo-ethnics, which seemed to be very like hardline, sort of, this is folk music.
That was
the
term he invented, yeah, for the kids in New York who wanted to not just sing folk songs, but wanted to sound like real old farmers and sharecroppers from down south, yeah.
Yeah, and so the thing is that he had a theory, I thought, actually. One of the things that I think came out in the book that you co-authored with him, the idea that there was an evolution, there was an evolutionary process to what was called folk music, and that it was actually music and songs that developed, and as humans sang them and their experiences changed and developed, the songs developed and changed. And he went from that kind of neo-ethnic kind of thing or his looking to traditional folk songs to actually then saying, okay, this is developing and things are becoming very different. And he developed a really, really broad musical base, which we're going to explore for a little while. But that was kind of interesting to me, because he said, at one point he even said, I really wouldn't even call myself a folk singer now.
Yeah, no, he never, ever wanted to call himself a folk singer. I mean, he always felt like he was a singer. If he had to pick a genre, he probably would have picked jazz. But he just felt like, you know, he was a cabaret, New York cabaret singer, and he was looking for good material. And whether that material was an old English ballad or something new written by someone like Joni Mitchell or Bertolt Brecht or Cole Porter, you know, if it suited his voice and his taste, he wanted to do it.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is, too, though, is that there was something else that, you know, like when you listen to that Cruel Ship's Captain, when you listen to that and you listen to some of the other songs that he does, some of the blues songs that he does, that what he brings to it with his voice. And I remember the first time that I saw him was like, I was like 17, but it was at the Philadelphia Folk Festival, you know, uh-huh. And it was like, it just blew my mind. I mean, I never met the guy, but it was just like, it was like somebody I always thought, God, it would be so cool to know that man, because it just captured so much. It gave you a sense, and this is what tripped me out. It gave me a sense of the life of a song. And its connection to human life, the social life and impact of a song, and its connection to humanity, a very deep and throbbing connection, which I thought was captured in a lot of the music he sang.
Yeah, and that was what he loved about folk music specifically, that it did get very deep that way.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Elijah Wald. Elijah is a musician and writer and co-author with musician Dave Van Ronk of the book The Mayor of McDougal Street. And that's Dave Van Ronk's memoir. Now, Van Ronk was a musician who was right there as the whole culture was changing in this country. And the book has served as the inspiration for the Coen Brothers movie Inside Llewyn Davis. Let me ask you this. The biggest influences on Dave, what were they?
Jelly Roll Morton, absolutely. Louis Armstrong, absolutely. In terms of guitar, the Reverend Gary Davis was definitely the number one guy, along with Mississippi John Hurt. Duke Ellington, in terms of just how he thought about arranging. On the local scene, Tom Paley of the New Lost City Ramblers was the first guy who showed him how to finger pick. And Paul Clayton, who nobody remembers, probably did as much as anyone to sort of convince him of the power of that kind of white ballad tradition that we were just hearing a little of. Clayton actually did an album called Folksoul Songs and Shanties of Sea Shanties that Dave sings on, and that there are a couple of tracks from that on that new Folkways thing, which I love. But he probably is the one who really persuaded Dave that it was worth doing white music. So a bunch of people. But those would be the main ones.
You know, it's interesting because, and I want to play this for people, the Reverend Gary Davis. But I don't, you know, I didn't want to put out any of his religious work, and even though that's a lot of what he did, because I thought actually some of what gives you a little insight into Dave too, as well as Reverend Gary Davis, was Cocaine Blues. which I thought we could listen to and then talk about it a little bit, because it was one of the things that I think, wasn't that one of the songs where Dave actually really had to develop when he you know, took it up and played it, he really had to develop that finger picking, and he became...
Yeah, I mean, that was the Dave Van Ronk song in the early 60s.
Yeah.
I mean, Cocaine was what put him on the map, absolutely.
Yeah, right. Well, let's, Federico, let's check that one out.
Every time me and my baby go uptown, police come and they knock me down. Cocaine run all round my brain. Yeah, baby, come here quick. This old cocaine about to make me sick. Cocaine run all round my brain. Yonder come my baby, dressed in red. She's got a shotgun, says she's gonna kill me dead. Cocaine run all around my brain. Cocaine run all around my brain.
All right, Cocaine. Now, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm listening to this, Elijah, and it's taking me right back to that Philadelphia Folk Festival. And one of the reasons why it just really struck me. And I was thinking about this because this was something that there was a whole story behind him even, you know, learning all this, running into Gary Davis, learning how to play the guitar that way, you know. And actually, there's a story about that song, because that was a song, while I guess Gary Davis wrote it, but he never played it, right?
Right. No, he was a reverend. He did not believe in playing stuff like that. God knows if he wrote it. Who the hell knows where that thing came from?
Ah, okay. Well, that's actually an important thing when we're talking about this evolution of a song, too, because there were many folk songs and many blues songs that people have no idea who wrote what. And so that was sort of that ethos that was being created in that whole scene in the village of, like, you know, there wasn't like proprietary relationships over the art.
Well, it okay. Depended who you were talking to. I mean, Paul Clayton, who I just mentioned, at one point developed the motto, if you can't write, rewrite. If you can't rewrite, copyright.
Oh, but Dave didn't have that motto, did he?
No. Dave, in fact, that's, I have to say, I'm sort of sad about that right now, because he so much didn't have that actually there are a couple of songs in the Coen Brothers film that they play his arrangement virtually note for note, but Dave always considered that something that you don't claim, so his widow isn't getting the royalties for those. No, and he, in fact, he's funny that way, because he actually wrote entire verses to things. There's an old Blind Blake song called That'll Never Happen No More that if you hear almost anyone play it, the second verse they sing is something Van Ronk wrote that a lot of people think was in the original, but it isn't. But he never put his name on it. He never took credit.
Now, he did that with a number of songs. I remember reading in your book where he talked about, look, I haven't written a lot of these, but if I see something where I need to add a verse or I need to change something, I'll do it.
Absolutely. And also just in terms of making it a song that he wanted to sing that. I mean, there were a lot of old blues songs that had verses that one way or another were really obnoxious about beating their wives or whatever. And he figured, and boy, do I wish a lot of other young performers understood this. You don't have to sing a verse you disagree with. You can always write it into something you agree with.
I'm with you 100% on that. You know, you really do wish people would actually say, take that kind of stand, because it's so rare. You know, they treat it as like whatever anybody says, it's, no matter how misogynistic.
Well, it's really funny, because when the whole feminist thing started, Dave was completely pissed off. He was very much an old line guy. And I said to him, but Dave, you always changed all these songs to remove that kind of stuff. He was like, yeah, well, why would I want to piss off half of humanity?
There you go. Let me let people know that if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Elijah Walden. It's the he's the co-author with Dave Van Ronk of The Mayor of McDougal Street, Dave Van Ronk's memoir. And we're talking about the whole development of the scene in Greenwich Village in the late 50s, early 60s, and the impact that had on society, and the impact that Dave Van Ronk had on that, the role that he played in actually helping to establish a whole new ethos in society. You know, Elijah, I want to ask you, you know, because there's a point here about I want to ask you about one more song, and you of the people you mentioned, and not one more song for the interview, but one more song for this part. I want to ask you about Mississippi John Hurt's Spike Driver Blues. So I'm going to let people listen to that for maybe a minute or so, or maybe a little bit less, and I will be right back to talk about that. But I really wanted to hear it because that's a whole different scene than, you know, like you were saying, Cocaine Blues. Gary Davis couldn't play that. I wanted to know what actually Dave got from Mississippi John Hurt, because he seemed to have a period where he was just deeply, deeply into Mississippi John Hurt. And I want people to get a sense of Hurt's music as well. So, Federico, let's play. It's track 5, Spike Driver Blues.
This old hammer, it killed John Henry. Won't kill me, won't kill me. This old hammer, it killed John Henry. Won't kill me. John Henry left his hammer lying there on the side of the road, side of the road. John Henry left his hammer lying there, all covered with blood.
And that was Dave Van Ronk doing Mississippi John Hurt's Spike Driver's Blues. What was Hurt's biggest impact on Dave?
You know, it's funny because I had one answer before you played that track, and now I have to do a different one because I was going to say that he just loved Hurt as a human being was the biggest impact. And it was a real chance to connect to that world. But when he made that recording, Hurt had not yet been rediscovered and come to New York, and Dave hadn't met him. And that recording was off a set, the Harry Smith Anthology of American Folk Song, which had been the first big anthology of old recordings, sort of showing what was out there in the first wave of recording rural music in the 1920s. And that song's a perfect example of that. I mean, that's what African-American music sounded like before blues. And John Hurt was a throwback. John Hurt, even when he was a young guy, liked the old people's music. And he was one of the only people who really preserved that older sound. That's what it would have sounded like in the 1890s when people were still essentially taking banjo styles and putting them on guitar and singing these very simple songs that just had two lines, usually not rhyming. That's the absolute oldest sound we have.
Tell me this, Elijah. Overall, the influence of the struggle of black people on Dave, I mean, civil rights or any of this, you know, what was the influence and how did it influence his music?
That's an interesting question. I mean, you know, it was the fight of that moment in the early 60s, and he was very much a political guy. And so, you know, it was sort of an obvious place for him to go. He also did love the music. It also, one thing that it very much influenced him on was that he had no interest in bluegrass or what is now called old-timey music. I mean, it's one of the things that's funny about watching the movie, the Coen Brothers movie, is that T-Bone Burnett thinks of old-timey music as his go-to place for all of this.
Mm-hmm.
But Dave's position was, and I quote, "That's the soundtrack of the lynch mobs, and I want nothing to do with it." I mean, he not only was not wild about that music, he sort of felt like, let's pay a little attention to who those people are and what their politics is.
Boy, that's incredible. I haven't read that anywhere, and I think it's a great, great, you know, stand to take. And in particular with him, too, because there was, you know, as you said, yes, he was a very political person. And that's one of the things I thought was really interesting. He was very political, but yet he rarely ever wrote a song that somebody could say, that's a really political song in a stereotypical sense.
Almost
know?
Never.
Mm-hmm.
He felt like, I mean, he was a Trotskyist. He was an active Trotskyist. He was an anarcho-syndicalist when he wasn't being a Trotskyist. He moved around in those sorts of corners. But he felt like the best thing he could do for his politics was help out whoever was fighting the good fight. And the best thing he could do for his music was play the best music he could. And he didn't have a Pete Seeger kind of voice or stage presence. And his position always was, you know, nobody asks a left-wing cabinet maker to make left-wing cabinets. And there's no reason a left-wing singer should sing left-wing songs. You know, what I should do as an artist is the best art I can. And what I should do with my politics is fight the good fight.
And at the same time, he had that position that what you're saying, if you rewrite a verse that's really oppressive to someone or really, really, really is terrible and you don't want to sing because it goes against every grain of your being.
But
you know?
That, in a way, was, you know, as I say, his position on feminism was who wants to piss off half the universe, not that he considered it political. I mean, that to him was a matter of good art and bad art.
Yeah.
I mean, that was like singing off key.
Okay. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Elijah Wald. Elijah is a musician and writer and co-author with musician Dave Van Ronk of the book The Mayor of McDougal Street, and that's Dave Van Ronk's memoir. Now, Van Ronk was a musician who was right there as the whole culture was changing in this country, and the book has served as the inspiration for the Coen Brothers movie Inside Llewyn Davis. One of the things, though, that I found really interesting as well was, you know, the idea, you know, there was actually I found a song, and this is one that I kept avoiding listening to, and I'm not sure why. I never went to it, and it's a song. Is it? I can't remember the name of it now. It's an anti-war song. Is it Luang Prabang?
Luang Prabang.
Yeah, which he's really a pissed off guy in that one. What'd you say?
Yeah, I can see why you might have avoided that one. No, that was his, as he used to describe it, it was his protest against wimpy anti-war song. I mean, he wanted, you know, he was a guy who'd been in the Merchant Marine, and he wanted to, he felt like, let's write an anti-war song that really expresses how f***ed up this is. And it's actually a funny thing, because he wrote it to the tune of an old English song called Biker Hill that the Young Tradition had done, an English singing group. Are you going to play us a little of it?
No, I'm not. Because
I figured you might not. Yeah.
I would have liked to, but I'm not able to because I want to keep sitting behind this mic. Okay.
Yes, well, I just used a word on the air that he uses in the song multiple times.
Right, and you are personally responsible for the falling out of our engineer today. We caught you, man. Anyway, but see that that's interesting because at the same time, and I want to play a little bit. I'm going back and forth on this because one of my favorite songs, just I think it's, you know, the Irish sort of melodrama and you're always sunk in sadness kind of thing. The Bird on a Wire was always one of those things that were, no matter what, whenever I was sort of feeling really bad, that's one place where I went. And listening, I loved his version of Bird on a Wire. And we only have a few, you know, like 5 or 8 minutes or something. I'm torn between that or the song Clouds and the Both Sides Now.
You know, he called it Clouds.
He called it
Both Sides Now.
Right.
I would say if you're going to play one of them, I would play Both Sides Now just because if your listeners are like me, they've always heard pretty versions of that and may have just drifted on the sound and not listened to the words. And Joni Mitchell always felt like Dave was the best interpreter of her songs who ever did them. Mm-hmm. Because when he did them, you cannot get away from listening to the words.
Absolutely. Federico, track 7. Let's listen to that for a bit.
And flows of angels' hair, ice cream castles in the air, and feather canyons everywhere. I've looked at clouds that way. Now they only block the sun, they rain and snow on everyone. So many things.
All right, Both Sides Now from Dave Van Ronk. You know, Elijah, I have to say that is, I think, one of the songs that surprised me the most, you know, about Dave. It's just sort of just the emotion in that, and it takes you to a whole different place. And in a sense, even though, you know, he talks about he doesn't want to, you know, he said, you know, the point about I don't want to write doggerel, political doggerel or anything else, but he really did have an ability to just very fundamentally and very deeply affect. And I don't know whether it's the ethos or whether it's just that the mood of people, the way people, in a certain sense, the ways people see the world in through things like Bird on a Wire or, you know, Both Sides Now and all of his music, but the beauty that's caught in that and in his voice, I just can't get over
that. Well, the rough, that combination, you mentioned it earlier, of the roughness and the beauty. He always said he got that from Walter Houston's version of September Song.
Ah.
That sort of taught him you don't have to be a pretty singer to make something sound beautiful. And, yeah, he felt very strongly about that.
Yeah. Now, we have, real quick, we have about two things left that I wanted to ask you. And I'm going to combine one. And I want to let people hear this because it's a song that I think many of our listeners are very familiar with. But I wanted to ask you about, you know, there's a lot of people who immediately come up and ask you about Dylan. And so I'm not going to concentrate on Dylan. But there was a very interesting, you know, story about this in terms of the one song that Dave wrote the arrangement for that nobody, I think, ever really, or he rewrote the arrangement of, House of the Rising Sun. And I want to talk about that a little bit when we come back. So, Federico, let's play, let's see, it's the very next track. It's track 8, House of the Rising Sun.
Is a house in New Orleans. They call the rising sun. It's been the ruin of many a poor girl. And me, oh God, I'm one.
All right, House of the Rising Sun. And I venture to guess that not a whole lot of people have ever heard that version of House of the Rising Sun. What about it, Elijah? What's the story behind that?
Oh, it's a quick story. I mean, he worked out that arrangement, and Dylan liked it and ended up recording it before Dave could. And Dave was pissed off for about 10 minutes, but they happened to be 10 minutes when someone important interviewed him, and the whole thing blew up, and he got heartily sick of the story.
Yeah, I can imagine.
The short version.
Yeah. Well, what I'm particularly interested in, too, I think it was in your book that this was brought out, that he eventually found out, you know, like, look, I was asking my wife and friends, what do you think of when you think of the House of the Rising Sun? And every one of them said a brothel, you know. And when you listen to this, it's actually and I think it was in your book where you actually brought out that it was a very different, it was something very different.
He was in New Orleans, and there was this guy showing pictures that he'd taken of old New Orleans. And there was this picture of this doorway with this grill of, very much like on the Japanese flag, rising sun. And he said, huh, what's that? And the guy said, oh, that's the women's prison. And so, yeah, I don't know the truth of it, but that sounds right. Mm-hmm. The House of the Rising Sun, you know, when there's that song, of that verse about I'm going back to New Orleans and spend the rest of my days, to wear that ball and chain. That, yeah, House of the Rising Sun was the workhouse in the sense of the prison.
Yeah, exactly. Man, I wish we had a lot more time to talk about this, but I have one quick question before we go out. All right, Elijah, what the hell was going on with that jug band, man?
Which jug? The David, the ragtime jug stomp?
Yes.
It's a great jug band.
I loved it, but it was just
what was going on was that the Jim Queskin jug band hit big. They were on Johnny Carson and everything else, and so everyone wanted a jug band. And in New York, the Village Vanguard hired Dave to pull together a jug band, and he pulled together some of the greatest string players in New York at that point. Danny Kalb, who was later in the Blues Project, and Barry Kornfeld, the bluegrass player Artie Rose, and did these amazing string ragtime arrangements. And I got to say, the thing I'm happiest about the Coen Brothers film is that album's back in print, if only for digital download. So I really recommend that one. That was maybe Dave's favorite of all of his records. He
really
loved listening to that.
That's great, actually, because I sat there and I listened to it. And even from, you know, I know like the, you know, the St. Louis Tickle is something that's actually been one of the things that he's played in many different ways in many different places. But the whole album, I listened to it. I thought, God, this is, I was listening to it this morning. It was just like,
yeah, no, so, he loved, you know, because when he listened to his solo records, all he heard was how much better he wished they were, which is, I think, what any sane performer hears when they hear their old records. But that one, you know, it's the one time that he got all his favorite musicians together and could write arrangements for them, and he just loved the way that thing sounded.
Well, me too, and I'm sure everybody else will like it when they hear it. So, Elijah, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, and we'll have you back again sometime soon, so take care. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Elijah Wald, who is the co-author with Dave Van Ronk of The Mayor of MacDougall Street, Van Ronk's memoir. And it's a memoir about the beginning of a whole scene that actually contributed greatly to bringing in one of the most revolutionary eras of the history of this country and the changing in ethos that still, to this day, is felt across, you know, many places. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Takiyah Boyd, the mother of Tyler Damon Wood's child, and she's also helping to lead a fight for justice after the Long Beach police murdered Tyler, so stay tuned. All right, that's The Clash with Police on My Back. Now, 19-year-old Tyler Damon Woods was unarmed on November 19th when he was shot to death by the police in Long Beach, California. He was kneeling down, he turned to face them, and they blew him away. Joining us now to talk about what happened there is Takiyah Boyd, the mother of her and Tyler's one-year-old child. And Takiyah has been leading a fight to spread the word about this killing, this murder, and to demand justice for Tyler Damon Woods. Takiyah, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi. Tell us tell us what happened to Tyler.
Well, he was fleeing the police at first, and they were chasing him, and he ran, and he was very scared, you know, from the witnesses in the apartments were telling us he was very scared, and a lot of people wanted to help him, but he was, you know, turned down their help. He didn't want to involve anybody in what was going on. And as he was running and he was about to get on the roof, he was gunned down. They're saying the autopsy hasn't been released, but anywhere from 30 to 60 shots, they shot him. So they emptied their clips and reloaded on an unarmed man. And it's very tragic to me because I don't think anybody, you know, that's an overkill. Nobody should be killed over that amount of time. Over that many shots, I mean, I'm sorry. But it's just crazy that he was really gunned down viciously for no reason. You know, he was surrendering. He had his hands up. He was kneeling. You know, if anything, they should have shot rubber bullets or anything. But, you know, that's the Long Beach Police Department. You know, he's the 20th killing alone this year.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's very interesting the way you just placed that, because one of the things that they kept saying is that in the early reports on the murder, and I do think people have to be clear, this is an outright murder. When someone is kneeling down and he's facing away, he turns around to face them, and they just open fire, like you said, with anywhere from 40 to 60 shots. This is, you know, what's going on there? Anybody who's rational has to say, what the hell is going on there? And it's interesting to me because the first thing that they do is they say, well, we can't tell yet whether he had a gun. You know, that's what the newspapers do. And then the second thing they do is they say, well, you know, he was wanted for this and he had done this and he had done this. And they really tried to demonize and criminalize him as if that would somehow justify their outright murder.
Right. And that's what I said, you know, you guys know if he had a gun or not. They searched him before he even ran from them. So they knew already before that he didn't have a weapon on him. You know, and then that's just an excuse for why they had a reason to kill him. There's no reason to kill him. There was no reason. It was wrong. You know, they need to be held accountable for what they did.
Now, let me repeat this. They searched him before they began to chase him?
Yes. Prior to him running, he was searched from head to toe. They knew he was unarmed. So he had no weapon on him. No weapon was ever found. There was no weapon at all. And they're just trying to make that up to make it seem like there was a weapon, so they had a reason to shoot him. When they didn't have no reason, they're covering up everything. They're trying to cover up right now.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about Tyler. What was he like?
Really cool. He was really funny. You know, it just never a dull moment with him. You just spend one day with him, and it was life. You know, he's a different type of person. He wasn't just a 19-year-old. You know, he loved his child. That was number one. He always wanted to do it for our son and I. He wanted to make sure that he's always taken care of. He was good. And that was what he was trying to do. He was trying to be a father. He was trying to be a man. He was growing from a boy to a man. You know, and they didn't give him a chance. Yeah, he had this on his record, whatever the case is. He could have went to jail. He could have had a change. He could have turned over. You know, you never know what could have happened with him. But they didn't think that way, you know. So we'll never know. And now my son has to grow up without a father. Mm-hmm. You know, he loved that baby so much. You know, it's crazy.
You know, it's really important for people to understand what Tyler, who he was, and what he was like. You know, because again, like I said, one of the things they do all the time is they murder someone. The police murder someone, and then they turn around and they murder them again a second time. By murdering their reputation, by murdering, you know, the idea that even the memories that their family has, everybody, by trying to cast a pall over everything by saying that, well, this guy had a criminal record. This guy was wanted for this. And actually, when you look at it, I found it very interesting that while they ran all this stuff out, they were actually including what they said was, oh, well, he was convicted for a burglary or something in San Bernardino. And then they said, as they're reporting on it, they say, well, he got probation for that because he didn't have any prior adult record. And so he was not, you know, even there, they're offering a hint of like, he wasn't the monster that they were trying to, yeah.
And that's what I think, and I don't, you know, all the, anything that he had on his record now, the wanted for armed robbery or suspicion for carjacking, he didn't go to court for that. So you can't say he did that. You know, he didn't get his time in court for that. So we can't put that on him that he did that. It could have been somebody could have made a mistake. Somebody could have pointed him out and he could have been the wrong person. Who knows? But for me, he wasn't like that, you know. He was very caring. He made sure that everybody around him was taken care of. That's number one. If somebody couldn't eat, he would help them eat, you know. And that's what people don't know about him. He was very caring, very loving, you know. He's been through a whole bunch in his life. And he was just trying to be a man. He was growing. He had a child. This is his first child. This is the first experience for him. He has to learn that, you know, and he has to be a father now, you know. And now his son won't even get to experience that. He won't even get to experience a tad of what I've experienced of him. Very loving, very great person. You know, all the records and all that, nobody's perfect, you know. Everybody has a past. Everybody does wrong. But don't judge him off of what they're telling you about him.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you folks in the movement there, you make a very important statement, I think, both in the petition that you have up on change.org, which people should actually go and check that petition out. You make a statement that no matter what anybody did, no matter what, even, you know, even if Tyler was convicted or was proven that he had done many, many, you know, many, many things, committed many crimes, or whatever, nothing justifies being shot and killed while kneeling down and having done nothing at all.
Correct. That is exactly the point of our whole movement. The petition will tell you the whole story and what we're trying to do as far as the petition, getting the petition up to the city council and to the police department. You know, because we want these officers convicted like as if they were us. These are people who are killing people. We have 20. This is the 20th shooting alone this year. That's crazy. And then these cops are still out there. They're killing people. And I don't want it to be another Tyler Woods. I don't want anybody to feel what I feel. I don't want anybody to feel the pain that I feel or a son to have to go through what my son will have to go through. You know, I want it to be, I need it to end. You know, it won't end. I'm not saying that it will end, but I want it to be a change, you know. And the more people who stand up and the more people who are become a voice for the people who have been killed by these policemen, the more chance we have of getting these men prosecuted, getting these people, you know, they're regular people just like us. Without that badge, they're just a person.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Takiyah Boyd. And we're talking with Takiyah about the police murder, the Long Beach, California police murder of Tyler Damon Woods, a 19-year-old young man who was shot to death by the Long Beach police in California as he was kneeling down, surrendering. One of the things I found very interesting, though, I personally felt very moving and very compelled by this, you know, because you make that point in the petition that's up there, the change.org petition. You actually make that point where it's like you say the officers involved in these killing sprees and heinous acts of violence should be convicted, tried, and sentenced for their involvement in such matters. They should be permanently removed from patrol and their badges should be revoked. They should face the same criminal charges and punishments as civilians. Just because they have a badge doesn't make killing justifiable. In fact, they are trained to kill, so that should be held against them. That's a pretty heavy statement.
Yes. Yes, and see, they're cops, so nobody, you know, people believe their words. They're just automatically right when they're just a person just like us, you know. They're trained. They know what they're supposed to do. They know how to take people down. Killing shouldn't be their first option. It shouldn't even be an option. You know, there's 50 ways I know they know how to take somebody down without killing them. And they're just automatically just shooting people. Just no reason.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about unarmed surrendering a man. No chance. We have more than 20 cops there. So, you know, and then we have people shooting. Who knows how many people were shooting? You know, and they're just trying to cover up and make it seem like he was just that much of a. They were scared. You're scared. I'm scared. I'm a civilian. I'm scared. You're telling me you're scared. Then what? I'm scared. I'm supposed to call you for help.
Yeah, when you mentioned the number of cops that were there, actually, one of the residents of the area said that she was woken up and she saw several police cars speeding up and down the street. When she looked at her window, there were helicopters. She then said that they were coming in hordes, which is to chase one young man. They were coming in hordes.
We're talking about one man with no gun who's running, who's terrified. Mm-hmm. Any of the witnesses could tell you he was scared.
Yeah, exactly. Now, one of the things you also bring out, and it was very important to me because you've started a movement that is really aimed at getting justice for Tyler. Tell us a little bit about that movement because, you know, again, it says very clearly, our mission is to capture justice and end police brutality against defenseless citizens. And there's a number of times that you point out in different things that I've read that the role of the police in killing black people is part of that whole, in a certain sense, it's part of the whole conditions of life that black people were forced to live under, which actually is part of an entire genocide.
Right. In our movement, Justice for Tyler, we want his stories to get heard. People, it happened, people, you know, sweeping under the rug, or, you know, it happened, he was killed, and, you know, sorry to him. But we're trying to be the voice for him. He can't talk anymore, so now we're going to be the voice. We do marches almost every weekend. I have a march going. We just got out of the Kwanzaa parade, so we were in that, and that went really well. Our movement is really to get his story out. You know, we pass out flyers. We get people to sign a petition wherever we are. You know, if we're just walking in the mall, we passing out flyers. You know, I have a great support system behind me that really helped me get this movement out. And if it's just 10 of us out there marching, at least it's getting heard. And as I march, you know, I pick up more stories. I pick up more people who've been involved in stuff like this. And that groups us as one. You know, their stories are dying down. We want to bring those back up. We want justice for everybody. Justice for Tyler. Justice for anybody who's been killed by the police department, period. You know, that is our whole movement. Because if we work better as one than as separate little stories.
Well, you know, it's very heavy to me, too, because there's a point where you say that, you know, again, you emphasize this thing about wanting justice and you emphasize this thing about the nature of the police and what they're murderers, they're paid career criminals in uniforms being valued by the unit for minimizing the population by killing us off one by one. We as a whole will fight for Tyler, will not let his story go unheard. And I thought it was worth mentioning that one of the people that came up on this was a fairly influential person, The Game, the rapper The Game. Which
yes.
I thought that was a very important thing to happen because he turned around and he said, look, there were no questions about it. He compared what happened to Tyler to what happened to Trayvon Martin.
Yes. And it's crazy because we're talking about young men who don't have any protection on them. You know, they're just minding their business. They're stopped by these men. And they're gunned down over the fact that you're scared of me. But we're talking about people of higher power with the police. Trayvon, he was gunned down by a man, an older man, you know. He was scared of this young man. Well, how are you scared? If you're scared, that scared, you have to kill him? I get scared all the time. You don't just see me shooting people because it's crazy. That's how I think about the police. You guys are for our protection. You guys are supposed to be here to protect us, not to kill us. And you're laying us down like it's nothing. And it's crazy that they do that. And they think it's okay. They wake up the next morning and it's like nothing ever happens because they go out and they kill another person. And they sleep at home with their kids and they're laid down. They're with their families. And they're not knowing that other people are hurt. They didn't took somebody. They don't know how much pain we feel. Don't know what we go through. But let it have been a cop that got killed. Then it's all this crazy madness, you know. They're prosecuting a person to the max, to the fullest. We can't even get a little justice as people. Mm-hmm. We're that much not looked at. We're that much that below you guys that we don't deserve the same justice that you would get for if it was one of your own.
Very well put. Very well put, Takiya. And with that, we're going to have to wrap this up. But I want to let people know, if they want to get involved with this, if they're interested in finding out about how to get involved, they can do it through Twitter. On Twitter, the hashtag is Justice for Tyler, and it's Justice F-O-R Tyler, T-Y-L-E-R. Takiya, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Takiya Boyd. Takiya is part of the Movement for Justice for Tyler Damon Woods, a 19-year-old black man who was murdered by the Long Beach, California police on November 19th, 2013. Now, before we go out, I want to read a quote from Bob Avakian, and it's a quote that speaks very much to the role of the police in society. "The role of the police is not to serve and protect the people. It is to serve and protect the system that rules over the people, to enforce the relations of exploitation and oppression, the conditions of poverty, misery, and degradation into which the system has cast people and is determined to keep people in. The law and order the police are about, with all of their brutality and murder, is the law and order that enforces all this oppression and madness." That's Bob Avakian, and it's from his book, Basics. Once again, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Federico Garcia. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate at redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate at redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me, you can do so on Facebook and Twitter. We're going to go out now with Dave Van Ronk and St. James Infirmary, Just Because I Love This Song.
It was down at Old Joe's Barroom on a corner of the square. They were serving drinks as usual, and the usual crowd was there. On my left stood Big Joe McKennedy. His eyes were bloodshot red. Turned to the crowd around him. These are the very words.